add pressure to this because we only have like 12 days.
Congressmember Jim McGovern, why have you signed on to this effort? Why do you think it's good for the United States?
Well, I've gotten to know Robert and his family over the years, but I was a history major in college, and quite frankly, I believe that we have to get history right. And as Robert pointed out, the U.S. government knew a week after Ethel's arrest that she was not engaged in espionage, and yet they killed her. It is important that we be voices for truth in this country. And that's why I think this is so incredibly important. You know, we have appealed to President Biden. I, along with a ranking member on intelligence, Jim Himes, you know, supported Robert's attempt to get the NSA document declassified, which I think is a smoking gun. And so it's time for the U.S. government to do the right thing. I know sometimes we look back on history and some of the things our government has done are uncomfortable to reckon with. But you know what? It is important that we get this right. And so I would urge everybody to go to that webpage, send communications to the White House, to anybody associated with President Biden, and get them to grant Ethel Rosenberg a pardon, an exoneration, or a presidential apology. It is the right thing to do.
I want to thank Robbie Meeropol for joining us, the younger son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, joining us from Northampton, Massachusetts. But Congressmember Jim McGovern, a final question. You have a piece in The Guardian, a headline, President Biden, Stand Up to the Chevron and Pardon Steve Donziger. You're joining Amnesty International, Greenpeace, and Amazon Watch, and some 50 groups, and urging Biden to pardon the human rights lawyer who was targeted for prosecution by Chevron after he successfully sued the oil giant on behalf of 30,000 Amazonian indigenous in Ecuador, whose land was devastated by oil spills. But instead of paying up for its crimes in the Amazon, Chevron launched a retaliation campaign against Steve Donziger, who spent time in prison and 3 years under house arrest. This is Donziger on Democracy Now!
Chevron committed what is probably the world's worst environmental crime ever by deliberately dumping billions of gallons of toxic oil waste in Ecuador, decimating indigenous groups, causing an outbreak of cancer. And rather than pay for a cleanup, they spent billions of dollars to try to attack the lawyers who have tried to hold them accountable.
So that's Steve Donziger. Democratic Congressmember Jim McGovern, tell us what you're calling for.
I'm calling for a pardon for him as well. Look, I visited Ecuador. I saw what Chevron did. It is disgusting. I mean, you know, we should be ashamed that an American corporation left such a devastating impact in the Amazon region. It is grotesque. And Don Ziegler stood up for these people who had no voice. You know, got a judgment in their favor, and instead of paying up or coming to some sort of settlement, Chevron has spent countless millions and millions of dollars going after Steven Donziger and not helping a single person in Ecuador deal with what they left behind. We have to stand up to corporate excesses in this country. And I think if President Biden would pardon him, I think that would be a signal that maybe things are beginning to change, that maybe we have a system that can stand up to corporate greed and corporate excesses. I should also just add, Amy, that, Robert talked about the Rosenberg Foundation. Donziger's family, his son, has actually been the beneficiary of some of the support from that foundation. And so they're doing some great things, and I want to thank Robert and his family for all that they do to help people who especially are come under attack by corporations like Chevron.
Yes, the Rosenberg Fund for Children helps children of those who've been incarcerated. Democratic Congressmember Jim McGovern of Massachusetts joining us from the Cannon Rotunda in Washington, D.C. Coming up next, Canadian activist and filmmaker Avi Lewis on the resignation of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Back in 30 seconds.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south.
Billie Holiday singing Lewis Allen's anti-lynching anthem, Strange Fruit. Lewis Allen was the name, the actual name of Abel Meeropol, who's the adopted father of our guest, Robert Meeropol. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. After nearly a decade in power, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced Monday he's stepping down as leader of Canada's Liberal Party. His resignation comes amidst rising discontent over his leadership and growing dissent within his government.
I intend to resign as party leader, as prime minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust nationwide competitive process.
Justin Trudeau has been Canada's prime minister since 2015, but faced plummeting popular support as well as opposition with his own party. His finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, resigned last month amidst a public dispute over how to respond to Trump's vow to impose a 25% tariff on Canadian goods. Freeland is considered one of the possible successors to Trudeau, as is the close ally, Dominic LeBlanc, who was appointed to replace Freeland in December. Canada is scheduled to hold federal elections this year, and polls indicate Canada's Conservatives would win elections if they were held today. The Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, who's been compared to Donald Trump, has pushed anti-labor, anti-regulation measures and called for expanding oil and gas development. At his news conference Tuesday, President-elect Trump, who's repeatedly mocked Canada as America's 51st state, threatened to use economic force to absorb Canada into the United States.
Are you also considering military force to annex and acquire
Canada? No. Economic force. Because Canada and the United States, that would really be something. You get rid of that artificially drawn line, and you take a look at what that looks like, and it would also be much better for national security. Don't forget, we basically protect Canada. But here's the problem with Canada. So many friends up there.
Trump continued his push Tuesday evening, posting maps on social media showing Canada as part of the United States, while Trudeau responded saying there isn't a snowball's chance in hell that the two countries will join. For more on Prime Minister Trudeau, Canadian politics, the future of U.S.-Canada relations, we're joined by Avi Lewis, Canadian documentary filmmaker, activist, also candidate in Canada's upcoming federal election, running for the New Democratic Party in Vancouver Centre. Thanks so much for joining us, Avi. Can you talk about the significance of what's happening, the resignation of Prime Minister Trudeau, and President Trump threatening to absorb Canada?
Amy, it's great to be back with you. It's been too long. We've had an eventful series of weeks here in Canada. I think as of last weekend, I was the last person in Canada who still thought that Justin Trudeau would run in the next election. He clearly still believes he's the only person who can lead his party, but he's been down 10 or 20% in the polls for a year and a half. He's faced, as you said, an uprising in his own party. And just like Joe Biden, he waited way too long. And his ego got in the way. And now he's finally admitted that he can't do it. And there'll be a chaotic scramble and a leadership race. And I think we'll definitely face an election in the spring. So Canada is in turmoil right at a time when we have a very consequential showdown with your president-elect. And our Pierre Poilievre, our polite Canadian Trump in a T-shirt, is way ahead in the polls. And so we're going to have a very intense and very important debate in Canada about integration with the United States. Well, I mean, the irony here, Amy, as you know and have covered for decades, is that the whole point of Canadian-American so-called free trade, the Canada-U.S. free trade deal first in 1988 and then NAFTA and following deals, have been to integrate our economies, to give the United States unfettered access, particularly to our oil. And we're by the free trade, so-called free trade treaties, we're not allowed to reduce oil exports to the United States. by any significant way. Obviously, a problem in a time of climate emergency, but there's already immense integration between our economies. And obviously, these tariffs that Trump has been threatening would be absolutely brutal for working families on both sides of the border, and would reignite the inflation crisis and the cost of living crisis. So that's the political debate we're having now. As far as Trump, you know, threatening the usual stuff, you know, it's a little bit of a balancing act. We have to take it seriously, but we can't overreact. That's what a bully wants, to send people running in fear. We don't take the bait here. And I'm proud that the New Democratic Party leader, Jagmeet Singh, is the only Canadian political leader who's talking about retaliatory tariffs in response to this latest cartoon threat, which is how it will have to play out. But we should look at how this fits into a pattern with Trump. He's a grabber. He wants to grab Panama. He wants to grab Greenland. He grabs women. For him, the whole point of power is to use it. Using force as an expression of his own power is the way he's conducted his personal life, is the way he's conducted his business life. And now he doesn't understand why he can't use the U.S. military and the U.S. economy the same way. So it is a real threat, and Canadians should get mobilized to fight it, especially to protect our water, because he talked in the fall about turning on this huge faucet and having access to Canada's water, and to get back to the free trade agenda that conservatives and liberals have implemented to the immense harm of working people in Canada over the last decades. It was always about water, and both conservatives and liberals in Canada were prepared to put water on the table, and only the New Democratic Party and social movements, incredible civil society organizations, have risen again and again to stop the sale of our water.
Would you say if there were an election held today that the conservatives would win, but because of what Trump is saying right now, you know, talking about absorbing Canada and not relenting on this, that that could put the conservatives at a disadvantage?
I mean, I certainly hope so. They're way up in the polls. But it's an incredibly volatile time in Canada. And, you know, honestly, Amy, that's why I'm stepping up and running for office right now, which is not, you know, it's not an easy thing to do. It's filled with contradictions. But, you know, I think my grandpa said it best. My grandfather, David Lewis, was leader of the federal NDP in the early 70s. And the early 70s were a time much like this, an inflation-driven cost of living crisis. Just like today, the right was blaming immigrants and poor folks, people without work or housing who were living on the street, saying it was the welfare bums to blame for our problems. And my grandpa David Lewis said, you know who's to blame? The corporate welfare bums. He said, big business and government are holding hands in your pocket. And we're very much in the same place today. Like, every sector of the economy is dominated by a handful of huge corporations led by billionaire CEOs, and they are shoveling the people's wealth into their own pockets as fast as their soft lily-white hands can move. In Canada, we got five big banks making extraterrestrial profits, whether the interest rates are up or down. We got five big oil companies who have captured government. They were gifted a $34 billion pipeline that the people paid for, while big oil has used its influence and capture of government to block any meaningful climate action. We got three big telecom corporations, which is why we have the most expensive and crappiest cell phone service and data service in the world. We got three big supermarket chains, plus Walmart and Costco, who are price fixing, colluding to keep charging $10 for butter, even though inflation is down. In the States, you've just had Potato Gate, where the two big potato companies are the subject of a class action lawsuit for fixing the price of tater tots. Like, Amy, is nothing sacred in this time of corporate welfare bums? And then there are more and more people who are working for big tech platforms in the gig economy that have turned us, our lives, our intimate lives, and the value we create into a commodity that their algorithms mine for profits, like the big real estate companies use algorithms to jack up the rent, which in a city like Vancouver is just too damn high. So you got an Uber driver working 12 or 14 hours in their own car at their own expense, just working for the app on their phone and the big tech bro behind it to steal more than half the value they create. So the right wing is right. There is a small elite that's responsible for the fact that you work and work and work and still can't afford a decent home, nice food, and a vacation once in a while. But it's them. In Canada, the Conservative Party is the party of billionaires, the ultra-rich, the corporate welfare bums. But it doesn't have to be this way. And that's the beautiful thing about elections. And as we head into this next chaotic period in Canada, it's important to remember elections are a time when the people have the power to decide, when we get to throw the corporate welfare bums out. Before what we vote for. Yeah, go ahead.
Before we end, I wanted to ask you about Jimmy Carter. His state funeral is taking place in National Cathedral in Washington Thursday, which President Biden has declared National Day of Mourning. He died December 29th at the age of 100. When he was inaugurated in 1977, Carter fulfilled a campaign promise to pardon those who resisted the Vietnam War draft. He issued Proclamation 4483 on his first full day in office. Avi Lewis, many American war resistors fled to Canada, your homeland, among them your father-in-law, Naomi Klein's father. During an interview in 1999, Carter reflected on his decision to pardon Vietnam draft resistors, many of them conscientious objectors.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it was it has been a moving moment in Canada. Obviously, lots of bad things happen under any American president. And we've had a healthy debate about, you know, things that the American Empire did under Jimmy Carter that were not to be celebrated. But, you know, actually turning down the thermostat and putting solar panels on the White House and saying, hey, if it's cold, put on a sweater. Common sense. Forecasting of the climate emergency to come and the energy emergencies that have been serial in the period of climate breakdown and fossil fuel dominance. That was really memorable. His pardoning of the war resistors of Vietnam. I mean, that was a generation of 35,000 idealistic young people. There were doctors, there were professionals and others like Naomi's dad who came and helped us build our single-payer universal healthcare system. And that's, you know, talking about Trudeau now, part of his legacy is that since the pandemic, the privatization of healthcare in Canada has been absolutely terrifying. You can now pay $150 to get on the phone with a doctor in Canada. And that's what the draft dodger generation, the 70s generation, that nostalgia that we have for Carter, that was when we really built up our public healthcare system. And we have to fight now the corporate welfare bums and the rising right to rescue that vision of taxing the super rich and using that money to build back our universal public services so that people can go to the doctor and to complete the dream of Tommy Douglas's dream of Canadian healthcare, our grandfather, our socialist grandfather of universal Medicare, to include eyes and teeth and mental health and medicine.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Of course, Tommy Douglas, the grandfather of the actor Kiefer Sutherland, Avi Lewis, Canadian documentary filmmaker and activist, also candidate in Canada's upcoming federal election, running for the New Democratic Party, the NDP, in Vancouver Centre. Up next, the Pentagon's released 11 men from Guantanamo. They're from Yemen to Oman. We'll speak with two lawyers involved with their cases. Back in 20 seconds.
Water is deep, the road goes on forever, and someday we'll make this world a little brighter.
Water by Ed Askew, the singer-songwriter, passed away Saturday at the age of 84. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. After more than 20 years of being in prison without charge or trial at Guantanamo Bay, the Pentagon's transferred 11 Yemeni men to Oman to restart their lives. These men had been approved for transfer for years, but remained behind bars because of political or diplomatic obstacles. Before arriving at Guantanamo, four of the men transferred to Oman on Monday had been held at secret overseas CIA prisons known as black sites, where torture was common. In recent weeks, the U.S. has transferred four other Guantanamo prisoners. This latest push at the end of the Biden administration brings the total number of men detained at Guantanamo down to 15, the fewest since the George W. Bush administration turned Guantanamo into a military prison for mostly Muslim men taken into custody around the world during the so-called War on Terror. A total of 780 men have been detained at Guantanamo since 2002. Rights groups are calling on the Biden administration to resettle Guantanamo's last 15 prisoners and close the notorious prison once and for all. Six of those remaining have never been charged with a crime. Three have already been cleared for transfer by the Biden administration. The government spends $500 million a year keeping the prison and the court at Guantanamo open for this small number of men. For more on the story, we're joined here in New York by two guests. Ramzi Kassam is with us, professor of law at CUNY, City University of New York, representing Guantanamo prisoners Moad al-Alwi and Sanad al-Kazimi, who've just been released and flown to Oman. Pardis Kabriai is senior staff attorney with Center for Constitutional Rights. Her last client, Sharkawi Al-Haj, was among the 11 Yemeni prisoners just transferred. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Pardis, let's begin with you. The significance of this move by President Biden.
You know, Amy, we'll start with the men and their families. 23 years they've been in prison in the most extreme deprivation. It's prison. Guantanamo is prison, and it's then some. For 23 years. So the release of these people and their freedom for the first time after all of this time, the chance to reunify with their families and begin to recover and rebuild is, you know, it's hard to overstate the enormity of that.
Tell
for
us
them.
About Sharkawi.
Sharkawi is 51. He's been inside since, I think he was captured when he was 28, 29.
Where?
Abroad in Pakistan. It's been 23 years in Guantanamo. He's gone through his entire 30s and 40s there. He's lost both of his parents in prison. He is among the men you mentioned who was held in CIA sites before he was brought to Guantanamo in 2004. He was held in those sites for over 2 years and experienced.
What was he charged with?
Nothing. Nothing. He wasn't charged with anything. None of the men, the vast majority, most of the men at Guantanamo have never been charged with anything. There are nine people in the system now who have been charged or convicted.
And explain why Guantanamo exists, precisely for that reason, right? So you can engage in extrajudicial. Explain what extrajudicial laws are, that you can be held for 23 years and never charged.
I mean, Guantanamo was set up as a place it was an intelligence gathering operation. The point of it was to establish a place offshore where people could be held outside the bounds of the law without access to courts, incommunicado, and where they could be interrogated. It was an intelligence gathering operation from the beginning. It's why the site was chosen, and they were held without charge, without access to lawyers or courts for 2 years into their detention. The treatment they suffered was for the purpose of breaking them down. I mean, Guantanamo has such a long history that we've forgotten. It's been documented in scores. But the things that these people have been through, and Sharkawi, you know, speak on his behalf in CIA sites, is the worst of what we do. So in terms of the significance, you know, it is the end of that acuteness, the acuteness of that, and a chance to, you know.
Will they be imprisoned in Oman, or will they be free?
They will not. They've landed as free people. Oman has taken people in before. There are about 30 people who were taken in 2015 to 2017. Oman provided them support and rehabilitation. It's been a relatively good resettlement. There are questions about the group that was, the Yemenis who were sent there before were sent back against their will, in some cases, to Yemen after years of being in Oman, and there is a question about that. And it's important to say that by deciding to take these men in, Oman has an obligation of protection and support.
Let me ask Ramzi Kassin about the two men that you represented, and that you, in the last 2 years, have served as senior policy advisor at the White House, and also with your students have represented 15 prisoners at Guantanamo, at Bagram Air Base, other secret or U.S. Disclosed U.S. facilities worldwide. Tell us about the two men.
Maaz al-Alwi is also a Yemeni national. He's one of the very first prisoners who arrived at Guantanamo almost. I mean, the prison was opened on January 11, 2002. He was on the second or the third plane. You could tell by his low internment serial number, 028. He was never charged with any crime. He was, like the majority of prisoners at Guantanamo, sold for a bounty, $5,000 to $15,000 that the U.S. government was paying to tribes in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region for so-called Arabs out of place. And, you know, by the government's own allegations, Mr. Alwi never so much as fired a shot at U.S. forces or their allies. Still, he spent 23 years, over half of his life, at Guantanamo. He became an accomplished artist at that time. Sanad al-Kazemi, like Pardis's client, Sanad al-Kazemi survived the CIA black sites. He was disappeared in the United Arab Emirates, survived severe forms of physical and psychological torture at a prison that the prisoners who survived it called the Prison of Darkness or the Dark Prison. The CIA called it the Salt Pit or Cobalt in the Senate's report about the torture that happened there. And he was brought to Guantanamo in 2004. He was also never charged with a crime. He has four kids that he hasn't seen for, you know, the better part of their lives. And, you know, he was looking forward to, as much as possible, try to rebuild and try to reintegrate these roles as a father.
Tell me about the art. That Alwi, I mean, he's a real, I mean, the level of artistry here. What was Trump's response when the New York Times did a profile of him as an artist?
Yeah, the Trump administration at the time and the Department of Defense under President Trump at the time declared that, basically banned Guantanamo art, declared that the prisoners could no longer export their art from the island prison to the outside world. All of that because there was a show displaying the art, not just of Mr. Alwi, but many of the other prisoners at John Jay College, which is part of the City University of New York. And so the Department of Defense decided to impose a ban on Guantanamo art, declaring that the art was literally the property of the U.S. government. We had officials threaten some of our clients that their art would be seized and destroyed. Now, thankfully, you know, our understanding is that Mr. Alwi was able to take much of his art with him to Oman, and he looks forward to continuing with that skill set to express himself.
We just have about a minute. What does Biden need to do? He has, what, just over a week left?
Guantanamo has always been a question of political will. Biden actually has an opportunity to do more than he has already done. Perhaps the single most remarkable thing about the transfer of the 11 prisoners this week is that there has been complete silence from the Republican camp. And that's because Guantanamo is no longer as politically valuable as it once was. The Republican, and this may be the depressing way of looking at it, the Republicans have so thoroughly won on every front, including with the last election, that they no longer need to beat up the Democrats over Guantanamo. And in that lies an opportunity for President Biden.
And even with DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, the $500 million spent on a prison for what, it's now 15 men, Pardis? Your final comment.
And concretely, there are six of the 15 men have never been charged, will never be charged. Three of those men have been cleared for transfer and are awaiting transfer. Those men should be transferred at a minimum, and that includes a CCR client who remains, Ghulid Duran Hassan from Somalia. At a minimum, this DOJ should drop its opposition to their habeas cases, to the habeas cases of anyone who will remain.
And are you calling for the prison to be closed?
We are calling for the end of the system of indefinite detention to close, and they are very close to doing that. That can be done.
We're going to leave it there. Pardis Kabriai is a senior staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and attorney Ramzi Kassim is a professor at CUNY Law School. Their clients are Yemeni prisoners just transferred to Oman. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Listen to Scream Therapy, a show about the link between punk rock and mental health, hosted by me, Jason Schurz. I've been part of the music scene for more than 30 years. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and my whole life was thrown sideways. As part of my recovery, I've slowly returned to the music that I love. Join me and my resilient guests for no-holds-barred conversations right here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University, Thursdays at 12:30 a.m. And until then, take care and be well.
Hello. This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.